You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Teamsters Local 41 and Communications Workers Local 6360. Teamsters Local 41 is the largest Teamster local in Kansas City and the surrounding area and represents approximately 6,000 members in many industries, including freight, UPS, dairy, food and beverage, bakery, warehouse, car haul, car dealers, car rental, parking, and show work. We help workers and their families achieve and live the American dream. Our members are hardworking, patriotic, caring, family-oriented, and civic-minded, and we proudly support our men and women in uniform that put their lives on the line every day to protect our rights and freedom. And Communications Workers of America Local 6360 represents workers at AT&T, Landtel Communications, Rogers Printing, E2 Embroidery, Mood Media, and 911 dispatchers for the City of Independence and Jackson County. We work every day to protect workers' rights. Buying union-made products helps us all keep good jobs. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. And on tonight's show, we have two sections to the show. The first asks, should college be affordable for all? And then in the second section, we talk to Andy Fisher about his book on the hunger industrial complex and why it is that the system is set up so that we'll never eradicate hunger. In the news, labor activists investing labor rights violations at Ivanka Trump's Chinese supplier have disappeared, and UMKC suspends operations for its worker education and labor studies program. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ario, and her headlines are UAW focuses on safety in Tesla organizing effort, U.S. workers rate themselves in fair to poor health, and Georgia congressman resurrects bad idea for poultry workers. Now for the news.
And this is the news from our side, June 1st, 2017. Amid big budget cuts from the governor and state legislature, UMKC has suspended operations of the Worker Education and Labor Studies program and laid off its director, Judy Ansel. The Labor Education Program is the only program to be entirely cut in the College of Arts and Sciences amid 30 or so layoffs. The dean, Wayne Vaught, faulted Ansel for not generating enough student credit hours, although the job of director included providing non-credit classes, producing the show, and extensive speaking in the community. Questions remain about missing money from a stipend of over $42,000 a year provided by the UM system to support the program Certificate in Labor Studies program, and also what will happen to students currently enrolled in the certificate program who now may not be able to get the classes that they need to complete it. WELS is the only labor education program in Western Missouri and provides both credit and non-credit classes for students, union members, and members of the community. The reaction among area unions has been dismay and a sense of betrayal by an institution they have consistently supported politically. Leaders and members are registering their protest by calling UMKC Chancellor Leo Morton. Although UMKC has provided support for the Heartland Labor Forum through the Labor Studies program, the shuttering of Labor Studies will not have an immediate impact upon this program. It will continue with its volunteers, including Ansel.
It appears that the City of Independence has a hard time keeping its help. Jeff Hayes of the Communication Workers Local 6360, which represents dispatchers for 911 callers to police, fire, animal control, and ambulance, announced at this morning's labor media breakfast that the city says it's broke and can only offer a 1% raise, take it or leave it. Hayes said that was puzzling since the dispatcher's budget is for 31 employees and there are only currently 10 employees because of the high turnover. So he wondered, how can they be so broke if they're operating on less than a third of the budget they had for employees? Hayes speculated that the understaffing must be affecting response times. Then Robert Mills, a bargaining team member of Independence EMS Workers United Local 1812, chimed in, saying that the dispatchers transfer calls to the EMS dispatchers and that calls often have to be diverted to departments in surrounding cities. He said turnover among the EMS workers is so bad at the city's ambulance company, AMR, that they are crazy staffing irregularities. Because of low pay and understaffing, the workers unionized and have been trying to get a contract for 3 years. Just recently, they got the City of Independence to force AMR to provide monthly data on employee turnover, its effect on performance, and what is in their plan to fix it. Perhaps that was a small victory, but it was their first.
The Daily Beast reports that men and women held by Immigration and Customs Enforcement are on a pace to die at double the rate of those who died in ICE custody last year, a Daily Beast review of ICE records found. And most will die in privately run facilities. All but one of the deaths this year and all but two last year occurred in privately run prisons. 9 of the 18 deaths occurred at facilities run by GEO Group, the nation's second largest private prison company. Gene Jimenez Joseph hanged himself 2 weeks ago at a core civic run facility in Georgia after 19 consecutive days in solitary confinement, according to immigrant advocates in the state. Days earlier, at a GEO-run facility in Texas, an Afghan mother seeking asylum from the Taliban tried to hang herself but lived. Atul Kumar Patel died of a congestive heart failure in Georgia's Atlantic City Detention Center that same week. The uptick in deaths have come after a spike in arrests of immigrants thanks to executive orders signed by President Trump. Despite the deaths and rampant complaints of poor conditions in its facilities, GEO has been the recipient of at least 3 large contracts since Trump took office. On any given day, 35,000 men, women, and children are held inside more than 200 immigrant detention facilities, according to ICE's 2017 budget. Attorneys and advocates are concerned that the arrests are overcrowding facilities already criticized by watchdogs over understaffing, poor medical care, and violence.
China Labor Watch, via Bloomberg News, reports that 2 Chinese labor activists were missing, with a third detained by police, while they're investigating violations at a factory that manufactured Ivanka Trump shoes. Hua Haifeng, Li Zhao, and Su Hong worked undercover under the direction of China Labor Watch at a factory operated by shoe manufacturer Hua Zhen Group in the southeast province of Jiangxi. They've been unreachable by phone over the weekend. Hua's wife said she was contacted by local police by phone Tuesday afternoon and told that he had been detained for illegal eavesdropping. Huajin's facility is one of 15 factories that make products for the brand founded by Trump's daughter. China Labor Watch has been investigating it during the past year. In a letter sent to Ivanka Trump in April, the group alleged a number of labor violations at two unnamed factories that supply the Ivanka Trump brand, including that employees were forced to work at least 12 and a half hours per day for wages below China's legal minimum, a monthly salary equivalent to about $1 an hour. It's the first time in 17 years that activists working for the nonprofit workers' advocacy group have been detained by the Chinese police, Li said. Hua was supposed to deliver evidence of violations, including images and videos, to Li in Hong Kong last week, but he was barred from leaving the country without being given a reason, Li said. A representative for Ivanka Trump's brand declined to comment. A White House spokesman didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. Calls to the Guangzhou Security Bureau went unanswered on Wednesday. Ivanka Trump announced in January that she was handing day-to-day management of her brand to top Lieutenant Abigail Clem. The closely held company licenses her name to vendors that make goods, including a $100 million apparel line made by G3 Apparel Group, as well as shoes made by Mark Fisher. Ivanka Trump doesn't plan to divest from her brand, said her attorney. She has transferred the brand's assets to a new trust overseen by relatives of her husband, Jared Kushner, retaining ownership of the company and receiving payouts. News from Our Side was read by Jen Zaman, Molly Madden, Chris Mann, and I'm Tino Scalisi.
This is Hester Dusick, yes. CWA 6360 retired, and I want to welcome you to the Heartland Labor Forum. The name of your book is Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. And Andrew Fisher, we do appreciate your being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. A lot of interesting things that you discuss, a lot of different perspectives. And this is a rough time of year for a lot of families because the schools are out for the summer. They have an increase in food needs, and because there's no more school lunch and school breakfast. So, and I thought about it, and there's no increase in the SNAP benefits when your children are home. So that's an additional strain. I just was surprised to see how much of an integration there was between the corporations and the food pantries. I mean, we have harvesters here, and we have a few others. Within this, you list several of the companies that are big contributors, and why would they contribute for the people who would be their customers normally?
Sure, and you know, it's virtually every sector of the economy contributes to anti-hunger work in this country. You know, and on some levels, that's wonderful. On some levels, they're doing their civic duty and they're engaged in their communities, and that is all fantastic. On another level, companies such as, you know, probably the most egregious one is Walmart, which uses its philanthropy as a way to gain access to markets from which it's been shut out. And also, you know, a lot of companies, including Walmart, fund anti-hunger work because it makes them look like they're compassionate, like they care about people, like they care about their customers. And it also is a way for them to exercise some social responsibility, but they do so without really challenging their profitability or without challenging the business model. You know, they're not contributing to efforts to organize workers or to raise the minimum wage. You're doing They're making contributions to efforts that are essentially charity-based, that make them look good, give them kind of a halo effect, and in some cases actually make them money, give them tax credits and tax donations, as well as, in some cases, like I said, as with Walmart, it enables them to pay lower wages than they normally would have to if they had to pay the full cost. For example, in 2014, the U.S. One of the House Education Committee in Congress found that Walmart's low wages cost it over $6 billion a year, cost taxpayers over $6 billion a year in public benefits. So we're subsidizing Walmart's profits by $6 billion so they can contribute, so they can pay low wages.
Well, and many others have jumped on that bandwagon.
Absolutely.
One of the things, too, I read is that with these agreements, so many of them, they spell it out to them very clearly that they do not want them to oppose them with their policies on low wages or whatever else that they're doing. And I thought that was bold. That was bold for them to just make that stand. Is that common?
Walmart is the most egregious of ones. I have not heard of it from other companies, but people know which side their bread is buttered on and are not going to bite the hand that feeds them. There's a really clear case, it's probably about 10 years old or so, in which Rent-A-Center, which is, also just payday loans, was very upset first of all, I had given $500,000 contribution to Feeding America, which is a nation's food banking hub, and then the Ohio Association of Food Banks, which is in the Feeding America orbit, was joining a coalition to fight against payday loans to make them less onerous on consumers, to hold companies more accountable. Rent-A-Center didn't like the fact that its money was going towards an effort that was harming its economic interests, and forced that Ohio Association to leave that coalition.
I'm not at all surprised. As I was looking back, and it says that, well, we've always seemed to have had hunger, and that the SNAP program was started by Roosevelt, and it was also, there also been a lot of support bipartisan, and was it supposed to be the primary source of food for our
It was never supposed to be the primary source of food, and it's still, and you know, the new name of the food stamp program is the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, so it is intended to be a supplement by Congress. However, the fact is that many people earn so little money, either through employment or perhaps if they're retired or disabled, they have no other economic sources. They have no other sources of cash. So SNAP often, not always, but often is the primary source of food for many families. And it's based upon an outdated formula, which assumes that people will be cooking over 3 hours a day. And it's based upon very low food prices, which are not always the case across the country. So for most people, SNAP runs out, maybe 3 weeks into the month. So that leaves them a week short, which is when they have to recur on food pantries or when they go hungry.
The original program, wasn't that to support the farmers? And now it supports
the businesses. The original program was developed as a farm support program. It was back in the 30s. Farmers were overproducing. The demand was low because of the Depression. So the Roosevelt administration created a program to subsidize farmers and allow low-income consumers to buy produce. Mainly, it was almost exclusively produce at a low level. That program grew into World War II. Then, as the demand for food increased dramatically because of the war effort, the program kind of died off into the 50s, and was picked back up when John F. Kennedy came into office in the 60s.
And during the war, we had the Victory Gardens.
Exactly.
I notice here the Coalition of Immokalee Workers have been one group that's been very successful with making some changes for working conditions and also for the workers. Can you describe what they did?
Sure. Immokalee is a town in Florida. It's kind of at the epicenter of the winter tomato industry. And the tomato industry, for historical reasons, has, you know, used a lot of immigrant labor, and it's been incredibly exploitative of that labor. There's been numerous cases of slavery and human trafficking that have gone on in the Florida tomato industry until recently. So a group organized the farm workers a while back, perhaps I think it was back in the 90s or so, and, you know, educated the police, educated the community, educated the farm workers about their rights, put an end to the human trafficking that was going on there, and, you know, advocated for farm worker rights, including, you know, better sanitation, breaks and the like, and wages. And what the main thing that they've done is they realized that their leverage was not so much with the growers or the packers, but it was with the purchasers of those tomatoes. A lot of the tomatoes were going into supermarkets, chains, and were going into fast food restaurants. So they developed a campaign and pushed, I don't remember how many now, it's over about a dozen or so fast food companies such as Taco Bell and Burger King, McDonald's, and others, to pay a penny per pound extra for the tomatoes that the farm workers pick. So that's a substantial amount of money. I mean, it raises their wages by $3 or $4 an hour at least. And that money is going into their pockets and improving their living conditions dramatically. So I know currently they're in the midst of a campaign against Wendy's and Publix, I believe, the supermarket chain down in the South. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they've also expanded into the strawberry and bell pepper areas, and they've expanded beyond Florida up the eastern seaboard.
Wow, it was.
So they've been enormously successful, not only in increasing and improving the livelihood of farm workers in those industries and reducing human trafficking and kind of exploitative labor conditions, but also in raising awareness about the working conditions and the living conditions of farm workers in this country.
Much needed. We have a lot of agricultural workers that come up here. Some of them, and they travel around and they follow crops. And when I read the part where the tractor in Florida, it was that the tractor does not tell the farmer how to farm. And that just goes to show, as it said, the workers considered subhuman. And I think this is probably a good part of the problem, is that it's lack of respect for the person, for the worker. Because
absolutely. And, you know, there's just a lot of racism within our food system and among our public, unfortunately. So that was just a kind of a great example of that racism.
I know that the trend now is for food banks, and before I switch to that, I wanted to ask you. I thought about it, and you say that the unions, labor unions, really don't get much involved in this, other than to organize. So they
right,
and I did think about it. I'm thinking, well, with CWA, we always did gather food, but we did that in the buildings where we worked, and that's who got the credit, was the company. But you're right. We don't normally do that because we promote a good living wage.
Yeah. You know, I looked at, there's about 200 food banks in this country that are associated with Feeding America, which is, again, the nation's food banking network. I was able to identify employment affiliation for 150 of those food bank board members. So board members at 150 food banks. So it was about 2,817 board members I was able to identify employment affiliation. And almost exactly one quarter of those board members of food banks work for a Fortune 1000 company or its equivalent in the private sector. So those are companies with $1.6 billion in revenue or more. And of those 28, so that's 700 board members who work for Fortune 1000 companies. Of those 2,800 board members, I was only able to find two who worked at a labor union. You know, not who were, you know, working somewhere else, but were members of a labor union, but actually worked for a labor union. And those both worked at the same food bank in eastern Michigan. So to me, it points out the degree to which food banks have become an appendage of industry and are not as community-oriented and community-based and community-driven as we would like. They're social service agencies. They're, you know, as one colleague said who used to run the food bank in Hartford, Connecticut, is, you know, we're mainstream, we're rich and respectable, and we want to stay that way. So they very much strayed from their social justice roots and are not as strong a social change organization as I would like them to be, and I think is needed to really end hunger and not just perpetuate the problem.
Well, in your book, you do say whoever's at the table shapes the agenda. And that says
absolutely, a lot of who isn't. And all too often, the folks at the table are, you know, especially at the board level, are those who are donors, who have access to money, or are well positioned within the corporate food sector. Unfortunately, the clients themselves are not at the table. And if they were, I would think things would be done very differently. Food banks would be much more engaged on minimum wage campaigns. And, you know, there's only perhaps a handful of food banks in this country that have actively supported minimum wage campaigns. Almost none of them support the Walmart workers or support the SEIU's Fight for 15. So they're disengaged from what were their labor roots back in the 80s when food banks started as a response to the decline of manufacturing jobs and the recession and Reagan-era cutbacks.
Boy, we remember
those
well. Things
have moved very dramatically.
Very much.
So towards a kind of a more mainstream corporate perspective.
So the hope that most people really have is either to have their own garden or to investigate their local food banks. What else would they do?
Well, you know, for folks who are on the edge, I mean, they're having to rely on food banks. They're having to go to the food pantry every so often to make ends meet. You know, what are the other solutions? Sure, you know, gardening can help supplement people's income and people's food supply. There's also, you know, just organize. You know, I mean, I say it very easily, but that has always been the case, and as always will be the case in struggling for people for workers' rights. I still strongly believe it's a matter of social change, not a matter of social services. That's what people do. Charity is what we do when there's no justice. And, you know, we need more justice in this country and fewer canned food drives.
If people who, there are many people are new to that. They've always been able to stand on their own. How do you suggest that they investigate where food banks are? Are they under hidden names or do you call the city?
Certainly you can, you know, if you have access to a computer, you can certainly Google it. I think the 311 function is helpful. It will tell you where to get food. The way the system works is that food banks are kind of at the wholesale level. So like you mentioned, Harvesters there in Kansas City, they aggregate supply. They get food from manufacturers and from retailers, and they distribute it to food pantries and soup kitchens, which are kind of at the retail level, if you will. And those often are in churches. They're not necessarily in United Ways, but they're often in churches and community institutions. A lot of schools now have pantries as well. So those are the places where individuals can get access to food if they need it.
I read here that instead of our reducing hunger, reducing those in need, we've actually gone from 12 to 12.7%. However, in other countries, less industrialized countries around the world, they've actually been able to cut theirs by half. Why have
That's
we not
correct.
Been able to do that?
Well, I'd say there's been a concerted effort around the world to reduce dramatic hunger. In the U.S., we're treading water, and part of that is because our wages have stagnated. The minimum wage peaked in 1968. If it had kept up with productivity, it would be over $18 an hour now. So while, you know, programs like food banks, like charity and food stamps and school lunches have taken the edge off hunger and have been absolutely essential in reducing the incidence of hunger, and things would be a lot worse without those programs, they have not been by themselves sufficient to reduce hunger in this country. What's needed is increases in wages, better scheduling, affordable health care, affordable housing, affordable child care, all those efforts that enable people to work and get compensated justly for their work.
And I think people have to rethink it because, as you say in your book, that poverty has been rebranded as hunger.
Yes. Yeah, because, you know, poverty is a difficult concept. We in this country, we have this distinction between the deserving poor and the undeserving poor. We believe that there are some people who, because they're poor, they may be immoral, or they may be lazy or shiftless, or they may not work very hard. They may have made mistakes in their lives. So it is harder to mobilize this country around poverty. And hunger is a lot easier. It's kind of the lowest common denominator. There's a universal sense that hunger is immoral in this country. Nobody deserves to be hungry, although they may not deserve the trappings of middle-class life. It's been a lot easier to move the needle on hunger and to mobilize public opinion and political power on that issue. However, it only moves things so far. It's a downstream solution. Hunger is essentially a symptom of poverty. So by treating the symptom, we're allowing corporations to play at the table, and we're perpetuating the problem. We're addressing hunger for today, but we're not getting at the root causes to eliminate it. We're not addressing making poverty impossible in the first place, if you will.
We do appreciate your book, Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. And Mr. Andrew Fisher is the author. And I'm going to have our listeners look for something special in this book. There is an organization that formed a union, which were retirees, and what their special requests were. I found that very, very amusing. So now I hope that everybody goes and get a chance to read your book. And I do want to thank you.
And if I could just encourage folks to go to our website, which is bighunger.org, and we have a newsletter. If you're interested, you can sign up for it.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Orange is the color that Hadiya Pendleton's friends wore in her honor when she was shot and killed in Chicago at the age of 15. June 2nd is National Gun Violence Awareness Day, and Americans across the country will be wearing orange, including Kansas City. From 5 to 7 p.m. at J.C. Nichols Memorial Fountain, this message, a public service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Do you have a car, boat, truck, or motorcycle that's just been sitting there or is a real eyesore? Why not donate it to KKFI and get a tax deduction? To find out more, call Bill at 816-994-7869. This is Colleen Moorbach, a volunteer at KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station.
Took all the money on earth and dispensed equal portions to each child at birth, that after a while it would all find its way back to the same handful that holds it today. Well, I'm willing to give that a try. Everyone gets a piece of the pie. When we give the money to the many at the bottom, wait for it to trickle up to the top. Give the money to the many at the bottom, top dog waiting for his trickle up.
Marguerite dwells in a dump, cleans hotels for Donald Trump. Swap their salary, she sits pretty, penthouse suite, Atlantic City. The money trickles back to Don. He can hire her husband Juan, pay them both a living wage. Trickle up, it's all the rage.
Give the money to the many at the bottom, wait for it to trickle up to the top. Give the money to the many at the bottom, top dog waiting for his trickle up. Henry Ford's first hurrah was pay him enough to buy...
Good evening and welcome back to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. Senator Bernie Sanders introduced a bill to the 115th Congress that would make college free for most low-income students. Senate Bill 806, the bill to amend the Higher Education Act to ensure college for all, provides tuition-free public university education for students whose families earn less than $125,000 per year, with no income cap for community college tuition. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo signed similar legislation last April, the Excelsior Scholarship. But many critics argue that because of income caps, 30-credit year requirements, no money for books, room, or board, most poor students will still be left out. And in addition to these concerns, federal and state governments are slashing budgets for higher education. So who is going to pay for all this free tuition? Could universities and community colleges take it out on their teachers? Joining us on the phone is longtime political director for the Congress of Connecticut Community Colleges, Robert Fernandez. Mr. Fernandez advocates for higher education collective bargaining rights, assists students with college debt issues, and lobbies in the Capitol, where he works for the passage of debt relief for students. Robert, welcome to the show.
Hey, good evening, Keno, and thank you for allowing me to speak with you this evening.
Gosh, thank you so much for coming on. First, let's examine this notion of free tuition. There's a movement going on nationwide in a few different states and then also nationally that seems to fly in the face of everything that we Americans hold dear, that we stand for. Why are we suddenly hearing so much about free tuition, and who is it that benefits?
Well, I think it is the free tuition movement now is bred out of the unbelievable high cost of higher education in this country. All studies related, either through federal studies and even private studies, show that higher education costs are much higher than the rate of normal inflation. And to make the problem even worse, federal subsidies such as Pell Grants and state grants that allow students to assist students with tuition have also shrunk and not kept up with the rise in tuition costs. So what we do have is about a $41 trillion debt problem. $41 trillion. It makes the credit card debt in this country minuscule, and that is bore down by middle class and poor students who carry unbearable debt that they can never get rid of into the workforce, and by all means and all metrics are then left with a severe disadvantage. With Senator Sanders, with Governor Cuomo, what the state of Tennessee, what the state of South Dakota have done is come up with a reasonable plan to allow students to attend state universities and community colleges to not only improve the economic well-being of the state with a well-prepared workforce, but higher education and education in general has always been the great equalizer in America.
Robert, can you tell me, so we're talking about free tuition, where is this money going to come from? You've got state and federal budgets, they're slashing higher education spending left and right. Where is this money going to come from?
Well, first of all, is the utilization of all federal monies that are available to the states right now.
Uh-huh.
The pretty much untold secret of the federal government that as it comes to the federal Pell program, now this is money to serve our poorest students nationwide in the assistance of college, both public and private, had a surplus of $3 billion. Because of the Pell Grant now is roughly $5,600 a year. So the poorest of our students right now get $5,600 a year to attend a state school, a private school, regardless of what the tuition costs would be. But by maximizing the monies available by the federal government and also by having the states commit to funding a higher education system, which is a priority, to them it's an economic development driver for the state. It's an investment for the state. They can get money from a myriad of sources. In the state of Tennessee, they started a lottery program. In South Dakota, they funded predominantly from the gas and oil shale booms. The problem comes in post-industrial states, as Connecticut is one, of where, and we now suffer, you know, massive financial deficiencies because our population is aging.
Mm-hmm.
Where does that money come from? But then we talk about fair taxation.
Sure.
On the upper 1%. So we keep coming back to the same issue.
And maybe...
Go ahead.
No, so maybe that's one of the things that I was going to ask next. If there's something else that you needed to talk about before we get to that, we can. But I was going to talk to you about what are some of the obstacles that the free tuition movement are facing on a national level, on a state level. Do you think that it's possible that you, for example, you mentioned this taxation. Do you think that the people in the 1% that make up the 1% don't want the working poor to be educated? Is that something that I'm making up, or is that something that you're finding? What do you think?
I think that the age-old question of the rich wanting to keep their money while keeping the poor at bay, you know, is age-old, and we can discuss a myriad of reasons. Education is just one of them. But I also believe that the same 1% who invest in Fortune 500 companies who are yelling and crying for an unprepared American workforce have a vested interest in capitalizing in American higher education. Now, we get back to the taxation question. And what does that movement look for? Well, the movement is twofold. In higher education itself, they look at it and say, uh-oh, we don't have money now.
Right.
What are we going to do? What are you going to do, like in the state of New York, that says, we might increase 30%, we don't have the staff, the classroom, or the facilities to handle that increase?
Right.
Because again, we haven't invested, right?
Sure.
Then we have another segment that says, well, it's a free lunch. It's a free lunch.
We don't have free lunches here. Right.
We don't have free lunches here. You have to work for it.
Right.
Well, the most staggering thing that I found out this year, when my 26-year-old niece came to live with me from California, with my wife and I, she looked at me and she says, you know, my friend's parents are preparing for her graduate degree. I go, really? Yeah, but they're really worried. And I said, why? Because it's going to cost her $84,000 a year.
Oh, my God. Where's she going to school?
In a medium-sized private university.
Oh, wow.
I don't want to single them out.
Sure.
Right? So the issue is how is a middle-class family who makes $100,000 a year, $125,000 a year,
uh-huh,
even for $250,000 a year,
right,
going to look at a tuition bill of over $160,000 for 2 years of higher education? So how is that going to be made up? It's either going to be made up by the student taking out federal subsidized loans and unsubsidized loans at various rates of interest rates. And coming out, let's just say for the sake of argument, with half, then a working adult by the age of 26 to 27 years of age, and as I remember, I'm a little way past that right now, but I find it a sin that a 27-year-old or a 28-year-old who is entering the workforce is carrying $90,000 before they even cash their first paycheck. Now, why didn't we have this problem before? That's the question that I think really needs to be answered. That it was up to about a 30-year period of time, the University of California was publicly funded and mostly free for its residents. That happened in my lifetime.
Was that specific to California? Was that specific to California? Were there other states or other universities?
I believe that the California system was free to residents.
Wow.
The California university system was free to residents. The vast majority of you talk to baby boomers, even in the state of Connecticut, who would tell you that it cost them $500, $700, $800, $900 a year. Okay, but for the rate of inflation, maybe in 1974, $900 a year was a lot of money. Correct, it was a lot of money. But was it 80% of your working wage? Because that's what your education costs are now, on average.
Wow.
$41 trillion in outstanding student debt is what is carried on the books right now.
So how did we get from having free or nearly free or affordable public higher education in the state of California and in these other places to what we have now, $41 trillion in debt? Like, how did, what was, what happened to from then until now?
I can tell you, in the state of Connecticut, as in many other states, post-industrial activity slowed down. The stagnation of middle-class wages, less and less tax receipts, less and less home value, less and less investment into urban areas, less and less investment into cities, less and less investment into rural communities, and then sooner or later, less and less investment into your universities, into your community colleges.
So you think that there could be a direct tie between, for example, I work at the Ford Motor Company at Kansas City Assembly here. Do you think that there's a tie between the shuttering of good manufacturing jobs to the increase in college tuition, or?
Absolutely. And then the issue is we look at the issue of manufacturing. Everybody talks about manufacturing for that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
But the vast majority of the manufacturing boom in the United States is finishing the product that's coming in from overseas because it's inappropriate. It was inappropriate when it was manufactured overseas. It didn't meet our needs. And it's easier to bring the raw product or a semi-finished product from wherever it's coming to, bring it to the United States, finish it, and move it on. These are high-tech, highly automated jobs.
Sure.
And we need investment into those workforces to do that type of work. That investment, those investments historically have come through your technical high schools in the secondary areas and your community colleges nationwide. And by continuously cutting off funding, because the state looks at any higher education entity as a revenue-producing agency, it produces its own revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as I cut the subsidy, I can keep the tuition going up.
Right.
To make my operating costs.
Right.
And because I'm getting less federal and state money.
And so this... So speaking, let's just go like maybe for another minute or two on the matter of funding, and then I want to talk about some of the people who are going to be losing out, who are currently losing out, and who will continue to lose out as these things go on. But the federal initiative for tuition free college that was introduced by Senator Sanders last, I believe it was April.
Correct.
That was going to be funded. How? I didn't quite understand.
They were still doing the appropriation of the federal Title IV monies that are available by increasing those appropriations, by increasing the amounts of Pell. What virtually makes the community college free in that sense, to use the term, is that the vast majority of community colleges around the country, regardless of state, their full tuition is usually lower than the full Pell award.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's program-dependent, but by vast majority, so that a student coming into a community college, a low-income student coming into the community college with a zero ESC, has a full Pell Grant and has really no out-of-pocket expense.
Okay.
At state universities, it becomes a little more complicated, because depending on the state university, then those that Pell Award could be anywhere between 30 and 40% of the tuition for an in-state resident.
Mm-hmm.
So really what you're doing is if you already have the money at the community college level, that's pretty much stayed, that you can provide that education for the lowest income students just on existing appropriation and loan. On the higher levels, once you get to the state universities, you would probably need to increase the level of Pell money is available by about 40 to 60%. But keeping in mind that fund had a $3 billion surplus.
Right. And there's also something about a tax on Wall Street, isn't that right?
Correct.
Okay, listen, I don't want to...
I hate to cut you off, but I want to see, we've got about another 2 minutes before the show ends. And I'm curious, how do you think that, I know that you do work with organizing faculty, staff, part-time professors. How are they going to be affected by this new free tuition movement that's sort of gaining ground?
Well, I think that we would hire more contingent or adjunct professors, since we already don't have enough professors to go around. And that's the other crisis. As professors continue to retire, things are not being refilled. Mm-hmm. In student services, the crisis is even greater. The contingent faculty and the adjunct faculty play a vital role in the operation of any major university in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And the ability of that faculty now to have more sections, the ability of that faculty to organize, because they're usually the lowest paid of those professionals. Can you imagine teaching at four colleges and still being on public assistance?
Okay. As a matter of fact, I've heard a few stories just like that. We've got a few here in UMKC.
Correct. With a PhD and probably between $140,000 and $160,000 in debt, which is probably in default.
That sounds familiar.
So the issue is that hopefully the contingent faculty and adjunct faculty around the country are allowed to unionize and collectively bargain fair wages. We don't want to hurt students.
Sure.
But fair wages.
And what can you tell me what the is there a national organization that's responsible for organizing adjunct and contingent faculty?
Correct. We are a member of the Service Employee International Union, the SEIU.
Okay.
Since 1973, the higher education campaign of all throughout the country. Here in Connecticut, we just did the contingent faculty at the University of Hartford, and are in our way of having a union vote for the contingent faculty at the University of New Haven, throughout St. Louis and Missouri, throughout Illinois, throughout California, Massachusetts. We're leading the way.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Robert. I appreciate you for coming on the show, and I have to cut you off there, and best of luck.
No problem. You have a great day, and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work here. We don't come to die.
Hello, this is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, UAW focuses on safety in Tesla organizing effort. From wardauto.com for May 30th. In its bid to organize workers at the Tesla assembly plant in Fremont, California, the UAW is zeroing in on workplace injuries as a key issue and appears to be picking up advocates. The UAW tapped workers' safety expert Doug Parker, executive director of WorkSafe, a California nonprofit that advocates for better health and safety protection for workers, to study injury reports from the Fremont plant and to train organizers working on the effort. WorkSafe study indicates annual injury rates at the Tesla plant consistently have exceeded industry averages. In 2015, the last year for which industry-wide comparative data is available, Tesla's overall injury rate was about one-third higher than the industry norm, and its serious injury rate involving job transfers or missed days was well over double the average. The Guardian recently published an investigation into the factory, where some workers alleged that aggressive production goals set by Tesla founder and CEO Elon Musk have resulted in unsafe conditions and avoidable injuries. With the UAW drive picking up momentum, Tesla is beginning to feel the heat. Tesla recently published a blog spot asserting that its rate of injuries for the first 3 months of 2016 were lower than the industry average. But Parker says with Tesla ramping up production, there will be a new health and safety environment that will require planning. He says it's not apparent Tesla is prepared for the challenge because 60% of the injuries are ergonomically related, raising questions about whether assembly jobs are laid out properly or whether workers have proper tools or protection. Next, U.S. workers rate themselves in fair to poor health from EHSToday.com for May 30th. Occupation, lack of paid sick leave, and multiple psychosocial factors are related to workers' own perceived low health status. A new study published by researchers at the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH, finds that workers employed in business operation jobs, such as marketing or human resource professionals, were more likely to rate themselves their health as fair to poor. The study also found workers who had no paid sick leave, worried about becoming unemployed, had difficulty balancing work and family, or who were bullied at work were more likely to report poor health. We believe this is the first study to show an association between business operation jobs and poor health, said Sarah Lucott, MD, NIOSH medical officer and lead author of the study, which was published this month online. Knowing which aspects of a person's job can lead to poor health can help public health and employee wellness professionals develop, ideally with worker input, tailored workplace interventions to advance worker well-being. Although workers in production occupations were more likely to report fair or poor health when only occupation was considered, once these results were adjusted for factors such as age, race, family income, etc., workers in the business operation professions were 85% more likely to report fair or poor health compared with workers in all other occupations. Finally, Georgia congressman resurrects bad idea, faster line speeds for poultry workers. From scienceblogs.com/thepumphandle for May 25th. Representative Doug Collins, Republican of Georgia, says U.S. poultry companies are being handcuffed by a rule that set the maximum processing line speed at 140 birds per minute. Collins wrote last week to USDA Secretary Sonny Perdue and asked him to consider raising the maximum speed to at least 175 birds a minute. He says it's a step toward removing red tape and needless regulatory obstacles holding back our economy. Allowing poultry processing plants to increase line speeds above 140 birds per minute was a bad idea when the Obama administration's USDA proposed it, and it's still a bad idea. But in his plea to USDA Secretary, Representative Collins asserts that potential risks to worker health from faster production lines are not rooted in physical evidence. The pump handle asserts that the congressman is mistaken. Workers in poultry processing plants suffer from a staggeringly high number of amputations and hospitalizations, and the rate of illnesses such as repetitive motion injuries is 7 times the national average. Increasing line speeds in poultry processing plants will make a bad situation even worse for workers. Evidence includes investigations by NIOSH on musculoskeletal injuries among poultry processing workers. Repetition or line speed is a significant risk factor. This is Mary Ariel for Safety First.
Oh, this is a Heartland Labor Forum calendar, June 1st, 2016. Representative Judy Morgan, Town Hall to review the legislative session. Thursday, June 1st, that's tonight, 6 to 8 p.m., All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. Empower Missouri First, Friday panel on reentry from prison. Friday, June 2nd, 11:30 a.m., lunch buffet. 12 p.m., the program. That's at Westport Flea Market and Grill, 817 Westport Road, Kansas City, Missouri. Enter directly from the rear parking lot. Representative Mark Elbrack, review this year's legislative session at a town hall Wednesday, June 7th at 7 p.m. And for more information, oh, that's going to be at the Mid-Continent Public Library, 1000 Kent Street, Liberty. We Are Missouri Day of Action. Drive through and sign a petition against right to work. Saturday, June 10th. Many locations. Go to the heartlandlaborforum.org to view the calendar. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee, Tuesday, June 6th at 6:30 p.m., All Souls UU Church, 4501 Walnut, KCMO. UAW Local 31, Third Annual Classic Car Cruise, Saturday, June 24th, 1 to 5 p.m., UAW Local 31, Union Hall, 500 Kindleberger Road, Kansas City, Kansas. Midwest School for Women Workers, Sunday, July 16th, Thursday, July 20th. Madison, Wisconsin. For a brochure, go to MidwestWomenWorkers.org and check out the Heartland Labor Forum calendar at HeartlandLaborForum.org.
That's it.
for the show. Tune in next week for the Heartland Labor Forum. We'll be talking to EBSA, the Employee Benefits Security Administration, all about pensions. And we'll have a segment called Trumping the Disabled. You can guess what that's about. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI.